with Chris, I met all kinds of friends of his, many of them very distinguished. And yes, it made me feel that I wanted to have some kind of identification as an artist, too. We were often the only queer couple in a sea of Hollywood celebrities, at least the only clearly queer couple. And there was really no way of disguising who we were, what our relationship was.
This week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 7th, 2001. The European Parliament this week adopted two resolutions, including support for the civil rights of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. Among the EP's recommendations to member states were sections calling for legal protections from sexual orientation discrimination and for establishment of legal status equal to marriage for same-gender couples. The EP also adopted its annual report on human rights policy towards non-member states, with gay and lesbian civil rights included among issues requiring urgent international action. That section says the EP stresses that homosexuals are still victims of discrimination, prejudice, and denial of their basic human rights in countries all over the world, and calls upon the 80 countries in the world which still prohibit homosexuality in their domestic law to change this legislation without delay.
In hopes of joining the European Union, the Slovak Parliament this week overhauled the nation's labor code and civil service laws, but rejected explicit protections from employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. Its chief EU negotiator, Jan Feigl, denied that the omission of gay and lesbian civil rights would pose any problem there. Feigl further denied that there is sexual orientation discrimination in Slovakia, claiming that the national constitution's ban on sex discrimination protects gays and lesbians. But a spokesperson for the gay and lesbian group Inacost, or Uniqueness, countered that the parliamentary exclusion of sexual orientation from the bill was in itself confirmation of obvious discrimination. Inacost called for President Rudolf Schuster to return the bill to Parliament and suggested that many gays and lesbians might leave Slovakia for other European nations where their rights are protected. Labor and Social Affairs Minister Peter Magvasi said that job protections for gays and lesbians would be reconsidered by the new Parliament to be seated after next year's general elections.
The British government this week announced the creation of a new Women and Equality Unit to implement the EU's Equal Treatment Directive, including its prohibitions against discrimination and harassment based on sexual orientation. The new so-called Equalities Unit will be headed by Prime Minister Tony Blair's own former political secretary, Sally Morgan, a connection gay and lesbian activists believe bodes well for the unit's effectiveness. Angela Mason, executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Advocacy Group Stonewall, said, "We see this as a positive development. It does indicate a bit more oomph behind things. The government is now aware they need to drive these issues from the center."
In Canada, Saskatchewan's two omnibus bills amending 24 provincial laws to recognize gay and lesbian couples both passed their third reading and received royal assent this week. The move gives same-gender couples equal standing with heterosexual couples in areas including pensions and second-parent adoptions. Saskatchewan becomes the sixth province to amend its laws in response to a landmark ruling by the Supreme Court of Canada 2 years ago.
But as the world celebrated Gay and Lesbian Pride in late June, there were major police raids on gay venues in the Philippines, Romania, and Russia. In the Philippines, police raided the new Coco Banana gay bar in Baguio on suspicion that the shows presented there were indecent. Although police did not actually witness those shows, they arrested 23 dancers and other staff for working without proper permits. Those arrested were released when management said their permits were in process. But police then raided the Coco Banana for the second time in 3 days, claiming the bar had no business permit. That permit, too, is in process, so the bar has stayed open. But gay and lesbian activists are calling the raids police harassment. They claim that Baguio's girly bars are allowed to operate freely while gay bars are not.
In Romania, the only gay bar in Bucharest was raided the day after the government had issued its emergency ordinance demanding repeal of the nation's last anti-gay law. Police were accompanied by TV crews as they raided the Casablanca bar. No arrests were made, but the National Gay and Lesbian Rights Group Accept reported that police interrogated some patrons about their sex lives and behaved in an abusive and intimidating manner.
On a single night, 3 of Moscow's 4 gay venues were raided by a dozen armed men in plain clothes who reportedly harassed and videotaped patrons and searched the premises without a warrant. The invaders refused to reveal what agency they worked for or why they came. At the Central Station and 3 Monkeys bars, they blocked all exits, checked all patrons' identification, and fractured one man's rib with a hard shove. At the Kazarma Sex Club, several people were reportedly beaten, while a few others reportedly were detained for lacking ID until they paid small bribes.
Fiji was rocked this week by the machete murder and mutilation of openly gay Red Cross director John Scott and his partner of 22 years, Gregory Scrivener. Scott had become a national hero as the one person allowed to carry supplies and messages to Fiji's prime minister and cabinet members while they were held hostage for 56 days during last year's failed coup attempt. Although some believe the murders may have been politically motivated, police believe homophobia was the more likely cause. A former police officer and another man have been detained in connection with the murders, but their fingerprints do not match those found at the scene.
The Toronto murder of gay Larry Arnold in 1994 has finally been solved. Paul Hatchie this week pleaded guilty to Arnold's murder and the sex slaying of a woman, as well as a number of other charges, and was sentenced to a minimum of 25 years in prison. A police officer connected Hatchie to the Arnold killing when the theft of a bicycle used in the crime turned up in a routine check for his outstanding warrants. Police will not comment as to whether Hatchie is being investigated regarding several other murders of Toronto gay men near the time of Arnold's death.
There was also a confession this week in Texas, where a 17-year-old said he killed his 14-year-old lover because their relationship was the last thing keeping me hating myself. John Paul Marsh was appearing at a bail hearing for the March beating death of Nathan Mayoral. He was released on $75,000 bail and will be tried as an adult.
Also confessing this week was openly lesbian convicted murderer Eileen Wuornos, often described as America's first female serial killer. For years, Wuornos, a sex worker, maintained that she had killed a half dozen men while defending herself against sexual assaults. But now she's told a newspaper that there was no self-defense in any of these cases. I just flat robbed and killed them, and there was a lot of hatred behind everything. After a decade in prison, Wuornos has also written to Florida's Supreme Court to drop her appeals and to request that her death sentence be carried out.
A suspect has been arrested in the bludgeoning murder of openly gay 16-year-old Navajo Fred Martinez in Cortez, Colorado. Martinez's death has not been officially labeled a hate crime, but the possibility has not been ruled out. The FBI has joined state and local officials in the investigation.
A New Jersey appeals court ruled this week that the state's laws against discrimination based on sexual identity also protect transsexuals. The prejudge panel gave transsexual physician Carla Enriquez standing to sue the clinic that fired her when she began presenting as a woman. The decision called it incomprehensible that the state laws banning discrimination based on sex and on sexual orientation would not be interpreted to protect transsexuals as well.
The United Nations began its data collection on the persecution of gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgenders in late June, as UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression Dr. Abid Hussein met with transgender activists in Buenos Aires. Representatives of 3 transgender groups gave him extensive documentation of cases of transgender persecution in Argentina, where cross-dressing is prohibited by law. His intervention was requested in specific cases, including that of transgender Diana Sakayan, who has been incarcerated under abusive conditions since mid-February without even a preliminary hearing. Hussein promised to include some of the cases in his annual report to the UN. He told the activists, "I've listened to many painful stories during my visit, but your situation is the hardest. You all have my sympathy and also my admiration because you are courageous, you are strong, you are united among yourselves, and you are fighting back. It is a pity that there are so many cultural and societal prejudices against you. Eradicating cultural prejudices is the hardest task there is. You'll have to pass through fire to survive, but I have no doubt that you will."
Some 500 transgenders from all over Asia met in Malaysia this week to celebrate the full moon festival Parnami Mada Vila. India's transgender Hijras have long used this traditional observance to give thanks to their protector, Jai Mataji, the mother god, but it was the first time they celebrated in Malaysia.
India's Hijras, gays and lesbians this past week gathered in Bangalore for what's believed to be their first public forum in the nation's southern region. 50 participants denounced India's 19th century sodomy law and lack of protections from discrimination.
And finally, can you picture 23,000 people dancing and singing to the Village People's YMCA? It happened this week in conservative Omaha, Nebraska, in an attempt to win a listing in the Guinness Book of World Records. The current record is 6,907 people, set 4 years ago in Missouri.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 7th, 2001. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Portrait artist Don Bacardi has few equals. The Santa Monica, California residents' drawings and paintings are in the collections of many major art museums, including the Metropolitan in New York City and the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. He has published 7 books of his drawings, and he's the co-editor of Where Joy Resides, a Christopher Isherwood reader. This Way Out's Steve Pride sat down with Bacardi to talk about his work, queer life in old Hollywood, and the 33 years he shared with Isherwood.
The film Cabaret was based on the adventures of Christopher Isherwood, as chronicled in his Berlin stories. So in the sequel, I suppose we'd learn our hero left Sally Bowles and Berlin for sunny Santa Monica, where he lived until his death in 1986 with portrait artist Don Bacardi. They were the toast of old Hollywood, with Isherwood toiling over his screenplays and Bacardi sketching everyone from Vivian Leigh to Betty Davis.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Well, that was a milestone sitting for me because she was a big movie favorite of mine, and it was made possible by Roddy McDowall, who invited Chris and me to dinner one night with her. And he told us she was coming, so I brought a catalogue of my work. And after dinner, I showed her the catalogue. And she started going through the various drawings. And something said to me, "She's not impressed. I'm going to lose her." And then she came to a drawing of Margaret Leighton. And she paused and said, "Oh, you've drawn Maggie." And I knew then that I'd hooked her, because she was a very competitive person, and she and Margaret Leighton had appeared together in the first production of Night of the Iguana, and I think Davis had felt that Leighton had bettered her, and so she was very competitive in anything that Leighton had done. She was determined to do better.
Ginger Rogers.
Well, she again was another important figure from my early movie going.
Nothing's impossible I have found, but when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again.
She seemed to me the epitome of a glamorous movie star. Lots of makeup, long blonde hair, a very movie star personality. Yes, she was fascinating to me. But really one of my toughest critics, because rather than defend herself as a woman who wanted to appear at her best, she criticized my drawings as a fellow artist, because she really was quite a good draftsman and also a sculptor. She had quite a bit of talent, and she had a definite theory that her face had certain proportions that were immutable, and her length of measurement was a finger. And every time I did a drawing of her in which she saw something that she thought was unflattering, she would go into this, what she called the calibrations of her face. So I suggested that we measure the drawing. And I had a little ruler in my equipment bag, and she and I agreed what would be the equivalent of one finger on the ruler, and we measured out the drawing of her I did, and you know, it was exactly according to her calibrations, and that righted her. She didn't have a comeback. She was proven right, and so she couldn't go on criticizing the drawing. So she then signed and dated it, and I got away without any more criticism.
And God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
Oh, I was very thrilled to work with Vivian Leigh. She was a stunning-looking woman, and she was such a charming personality. But now there was a restless creature, and she gave me fair warning. She said she defeated some of the best portrait artists of her time. And I know the difference from all my experience. When somebody is moving around because they don't want to be caught, they don't want me to look closely at them. But with Vivian Leigh, she was helpless. She couldn't be still. And after I'd done several drawings of her and felt that none of them really were successful, she then made a superhuman effort for her. And she sat for at least 15 minutes, and I did my only successful drawing of her. And it was such a strain for her that I could see beads of sweat break out on her forehead. But she was really trying, and that's what was so sympathetic about her. She wanted to help me.
One of your more frequent subjects was Christopher Esherwood, who was your partner for many, 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 many
33 years.
Wow.
We met when he was 48 and I was 18. And in fact, he was responsible for my becoming an artist.
Was that difficult? You're very young, and you're with someone who is very famous, to emerge from that shadow.
Well, that gave me extra impetus. Because he was a distinguished writer, I felt that I had to have something that I might be distinguished for. And that just goaded me to work all the harder.
In the 1950s, in one of your journals, you wrote, "I am not taken seriously as an individual."
Well, yes, you know, I think every young man longs to be taken seriously. And of course, with Chris, I met all kinds of friends of his, many of them very distinguished. And yes, it made me feel that I wanted to have some kind of identification as an artist, too. And as I say, that just made me work all the harder.
Tell me about Christopher Esherwood. What was he like?
Oh, he was the most charming man I ever met. What was wonderful about him was his genuine curiosity about people. He wasn't faking it. When we met, he asked me all kinds of questions about myself. Until I met him, I'd never known anybody to take such an interest in me. And he was particularly interested in young people and young men in particular. And he wanted to know what their lives were like, what it was like to be them, what they were interested in. And you can always tell when somebody asks you questions, whether they're just making conversation, whether it's just idle curiosity, or whether it's the genuine article. And his was genuine.
What was the gay side of Hollywood like in the 50s?
Oh, there were clubs and bars, and of course they were very dangerous because they could be raided at any moment, and often were. And a certain bar would emerge and be very popular, and people would flock to it. But most of the bars lasted only a very short while, because they were soon raided, and once they got a reputation for being raided regularly, they couldn't last. But while they did last, they were very exciting because it was dangerous, and everybody who was there knew that maybe that night the place would be raided and they might even be arrested. So that gave the experience a very decided edge.
I assume you wouldn't see the Tab Hunters and the Rock Hudsons out and about.
Not at gay bars, no. Hollywood people did go, but I think it was out of bounds for actors. I mean, that was just courting disaster. But people behind the scenes, directors and writers and cameramen, could go to bars. being gay in Hollywood, I really had an extraordinary experience because I had, through Chris, access to so many of these major Hollywood personalities. And that was exceptionally lucky. And it was possible because Chris was a distinguished British writer. So we did have access to all kinds of parties that ordinarily I would never have been asked to, certainly not without Chris. And we were often the only queer couple in a sea of Hollywood celebrities, at least the only clearly queer couple. And there was really no way of disguising who we were, what our relationship was. We couldn't pretend that Chris was my father, and we didn't take women with us to cover up. That would have been absurd and not at all Chris's style. So it was just on his credentials as a distinguished British writer that we were tolerated.
But at that time, it was an act of bravery. Most people would have marriages of convenience, or New York marriages, as they're called.
Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester were our next-door neighbors, and they became very good friends. And in fact, I think both Laughton and Lanchester were in love with Chris. And I think they even tended to quarrel over him. I think each wanted him for themselves. And in fact, Charles bought the house next door to us in order to be closer to Chris, and also in order to have a private place to which he could bring the young man that he was very much infatuated with at the time.
You're listening to This Way Out. I'm Steve Pride, and we're talking to writer, artist, activist Don Bacardi.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
What was your take and Christopher Isherwood's take on cabaret?
Well, we became good friends with Michael York. And we both thought that he was very good casting for Chris. Chris, of course, his attitude to cabaret was understandably resistant to the adaptation of his material. For instance, the Chris character is invariably made bisexual. Even in the Van Druten play, I Am a Camera, there's a suggestion that Chris and Sally are lovers. And, of course, that's very much against Chris's original, but he tried to kind of be broad-minded about it. And also he felt that as soon as Sally is made into not only a singer in a cabaret, but a performer of really expert know-how, that the character of Sally goes out the window because she was essentially an amateur. And Liza Minnelli belting away, she would have been the toast of Europe. And that's not Sally Bowles. He was very much in favor of the casting of Minnelli in the part, but once he saw her doing these first-rate numbers in the film, he felt she was totally removed from Sally.
You're quoted in a book on gay widowers by Eric Guitarez as saying that after the death of Isherwood, you transformed yourself and underwent a complete role reversal in the relationship that followed.
Yes, well, it was a very peculiar experience for me. First of all, reaching the age that Chris was when I first met him. Of course, he seemed so much older, and he was distinguished and from another generation, another country. And suddenly, I found myself the very age he was when I met him, and that was very significant. And he was still alive then. And then after his death, I found myself gradually being put into the position of being the older one of a couple. I met a young man, fell in love with him, who was 26 years younger than I was. And I suddenly found myself cast in Chris's role. And it was very illuminating for me because it gave me all sorts of insights into situations that I'd experienced with Chris, and I suddenly, for the first time, began to understand how he must have felt all those years before with me. And so it was a continual kind of communication with him because I was understanding aspects of his experience really for the first time. And also, his example was very helpful to me, because often when I had problems with my friend, I would ask myself, how would Chris behave in this situation? And you know, I always got an answer. And it was often very, very helpful to me asking Chris's advice.
This has been a conversation with portrait artist Don Bacardi. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Dark and cold was the night you came. I told you to go, but you stayed anyway. You held your finger to my trembling lips. You said, come in close, kid. I won't let you slip. You said, hush, little babe, hush, little babe. It's your favorite song. Stop all this fussing, boy, there's nothing wrong. Cool and swift like a bird we flew into the sun, into the blue. That's how I know I can love, I can love, I can love and be loved. Haunting me in my dreams you fly. I feel your chill when you pass by. I try to catch you, but you slip ahead. And then I wake, it's another day, and I'm safe in our bed. And you say, hush little babe, it's your favorite song. Stop all this fussing, boy, there's nothing wrong. Morning light landing soft in your eyes. We fly to the sun, we fly to the light. That's how I know I can love, I can love, I can love and be loved. There were storms in my cup, but no one could see. And ghosts in my head holding court just for me. But you breathed in warm, and I breathed in hope. Now I know, yes, I know love's what you do. No, it's not just a word.
Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Graham Underhill, Chris Ambidge, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Rex Walkner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. David Brown performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on multimedia, then on radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For an urgent message about This Way Out's critical financial situation, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on 2BOB Tyree, New South Wales, KHSU Arcata, California, WSUI Iowa City, Iowa, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.